Welcome to another exciting episode of the NIDS Viewed, a weekly show of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. Each week, we will discuss and analyze a recent topic and provide insight to how it affects our national deterrence. The view of the hosts and guests are their own. We hope you enjoy the show.
Welcome back to the NIDS View, a podcast of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we, you know, on the NIDS View, we discuss current topics, things that have been going on. Sometimes we get a great article that we want to talk about. And this week, Curtis, welcome back, Jim. Curtis, good to see you again.
Obviously, I wasn't gone.
Well, I mean, you guys.
But you're never really
week,
here.
I think.
Okay, I can accept that. It's the people I work with. That's why.
Well, it, you know, in the how's the memory care going? By the way, Jim, I know at your age, this is a common issue, but.
What did you ask Adam? I can't remember.
So Curtis, you know, he brought up a DIA chart. I don't know if you, the listeners, have seen this. It's a DIA chart. It's called Golden Dome for America, Current and Future Missile Threats to the U.S. Homeland. And what's really great about it, and I think Curtis is going to talk more about it, is it tells you all of the potential missile threats, whether they be hypersonic or FOBs or ICBMs or SLBMs or cruise missiles that the U.S. faces from both Russia and China, and then in some cases, the North Koreans as well. But it's just stunning what the DIA projects these countries are going to have by 2035 in terms of total numbers of missiles that can attack the United States. It's almost overwhelming. So with that, let me turn to you, Curtis, because this was sort of your baby to talk about. You know, as you read this, as you saw the chart and started to think through what the implications of it are, what was your take?
Well, thanks, Adam. This chart is stunning. It's a great way to describe it. So for our listeners, it came out in May. So I know we're a little bit behind in talking about it, but there's been so many other things going on. But we really wanted to attack this, if you will, this chart, this Golden Dome for America. But really the purpose of talking about this chart today, Adam and Jim, is not really about Golden Dome. And it's really about a fantastic graphic of what we face from these adversaries and what we are essentially trying to deter, right? These potential first strikes from these various, not only these various systems, the various trajectories that these systems can come from, and if not trajectories, the vectors of which they can come from. They possess various kinds of yields, and some of them are designed to be very evasive of our sensors and defensive systems. And all of these things are designed to put our nation, I'm sorry, let's say it this way, to hold our nation at risk, right? To perform an act of deterrence upon us and by our traditional adversaries. And I commend anybody who's interested in this topic to really look at this document. You know, over the last couple of years, gentlemen, you know, I've been pretty, playing the serious warning here about, you know, I'm just not sure that we get the straight scoop from some of these reports, these intelligence community reports to Congress, or these various assessments that are done by think tanks, nonprofits, disarmament advocacy groups, and so forth. And you know, we tend to wonder. You know, they say, you know, the Chinese will have a 1,000 warheads by the end of the decade and 1,500 by 2035. And these are really projections. These are guesses. This is forecasting in some sense. We really don't know in that regard. And folks out there, the deniers out there, will still say, well, that still is not more than what we have. But when you add those numbers, those Chinese numbers with the Russian numbers, you can determine or assume that they're going to work together, well, then you really are facing a larger number of a threat towards us. And in a counter-force strategy, we have to be able to hold all of those systems at risk in order to effectuate a realistic, yet alone meaningful, counter-force strategy. And so I just wanted to review this chart, and we'll do it here over the course of the next 20 minutes or so that we're on this podcast, because I think it is interesting to assess the numbers. And I'd like to start first with the ICBMs and maybe encourage Adam to look at the SLBMs here. But I want to start with the ICBMs. If you look on this chart in the upper sort of left of the chart, the Defense Intelligence Agency is projecting in this open source that China will have 700 ICBMs, okay, all capable of hitting the U.S. homeland by 2035, okay, and that the Russians will have 400, which is 50 more than they assess that the Russians currently have today, and that the North Koreans will have 50 ICBMs. So when you add that up, that's 1,150 ICBMs. Now, currently, the United States has somewhere in the ICBM world about 400 to 450 maybe-ish plus testing bodies and maintenance bodies and some other bodies like that. But at least for holes in the ground, those kinds of numbers. So we're looking at a significantly different numbers count against where we are in comparison. And this is a significant issue because we cannot assume that that a significant number of these Russian and Chinese ICBMs are reloads. We can count how many silos are being built generally, but we really don't know how many TELs are being built in the mobile mechanisms. And so these are all issues. And so there's a goal here by the adversary to overwhelm any future defense. And overwhelm even our ability to deter in a counterforce mechanism. And I think this is something to be concerned about. It's why I wanted to talk about this chart.
Hey, Curtis, just to add on to that, just recently, in fact, there's going to be a paper coming out by NID's very own Peter Husey about the ICBMs, because Cato Institute is making arguments that we reduce the number of ICBMs we have because the new assessment that Cato Institute, and again, think tanks, think around the bridges, think around the edges, I get it, but the Cato Institute has simply said that their belief is that the having ICBMs is provocative and even aggressive, that we were holding on to our ICBMs so we could do a first strike attack, which I think is rather interesting, given that ICBMs have always been in the U.S. inventory a deterrence measure and a defensive measure in the numbers that we have, et cetera. We've always, as our dynamic parity had said, you know, we'll just pair you out. As long as you can't survive it, we can't, you know, you're not going to be successful and we're going to survive that. Then why attack? So it's the deterrent there. So sort of a misreading of deterrence. I thought I'd add that in. I know we didn't talk about show prep. I mean, it literally came to my mailbox as you were talking and I saw ICBMs and I had to pop it open. So I thought I'd go ahead and let you take a shot at that since that's coming out. And of course, Adam, I'm sure you have something to say as well from a deterrent standpoint, from the ICBM standpoint.
I really don't have a whole lot to comment on Cato. I'll let Adam.
Well, I guess it's, you know, at least they're not, you know, violent, you know, detractors of the nuclear arsenal, which is really what Cato does. They're detractors of nuclear weapons. They're advocates of disarmament. They're libertarian advocates of disarmament, but they're still advocates and I'm not quite sure how that logic goes, where you say, you know, the Chinese are going to have 700, the Russians will have 400. Mm-hmm. And of course, on that 700, they can have between 6 and 10 warheads.
Correct.
So 700 becomes, you know, what is that? Over 3,000. Yeah. And then the 400, I think, you know, there's a certain number of Sarmats, relatively small number, that's got 10. So let's say, you know, there's a portion that can hold up to 10. There's portions that can hold up to 6 on the Russian. So let's suppose that the Russians have 1,500 plus warheads on their ICBM. So we're looking at, you know, 4,000 or so warheads just on ICBMs. And right now, and we're going to ultimately, our plan is to have, you know, 400 ICBMs and warheads in response to the, what is likely 4,000 plus. And my question is, under what logic is that? Are we the provocateurs?
Yeah.
I'm not quite sure how that works.
I thought you'd go that route, you know, Adam.
I don't live in Washington. I don't work in the Beltway. So all of that special knowledge and intelligence that you get by working inside the Beltway, I don't have. So I'm sure there's a reason why those of us that live out in flyover country are wrong. But, you know, what this chart, not only in terms of ballistic missiles, but when you look at just the panoply of capabilities that our adversaries have, I mean, let's take hypersonic weapons. The Chinese are projected, they already have 600, and the Russians already have 200 to 300. And these are potentially all nuclear capable. And then they're projecting DIA, which DIA has generally been fairly accurate with their projections. They tend to be decent. They're projecting that the Chinese will have 4,000 within a decade. And the Russians will have 1,000 within a decade, and they'll all be potentially nuclear capable. So what I would submit to you, and this doesn't have anything to do with cruise missiles that are nuclear capable, FOBs, SLBMs, which are all, you know, like SLBMs are all MIRVed. So we the United States, are going to be in such an inferior position relative to our adversaries, because our adversaries have never stopped being able to make warheads like we have. We can't produce pits that are the sort of the fundamental component of a nuclear warhead, whereas the Russians can build 1,000 a year, and we can't. And then the Chinese were, you know, the idea was that their limiting factor was the amount of special nuclear material they had. Well, we are, I've been a part of a couple of articles where we reassess the plutonium production of the Chinese over a given period. And then we also know the Chinese are now super besties with the Russians. And we, you know, the Russians had tons of highly enriched uranium. And so therefore, what kind of trade is going on there? We don't know. We really don't know. So the idea that the Russians, the Chinese, are in any way limited in the number of things that they can build and field to then coerce us into essentially doing nothing and staying in the Western Hemisphere, our position is eroding. Their position is, you know, it's getting better. And this chart is a very clear illustration of how and why that's true.
Yeah. You know, I want to point back a little bit to last week when we talked a little bit. We talked about the freedoms of our country and how people, you know, go about their daily business and do their shopping. I think Curtis talked about people going downtown, do their shopping, go to college, hang out with their friends on a cool weekend. And I was thinking about that after the show last week, but it fits in today because, you know, I'm an engineer. So when we throw these numbers out here, 4,000, 8,000, I've learned over time that throwing numbers at people, oftentimes they just gloss over because they don't hear us. And there's those of us in the deterrence community that do sort of center on those numbers. So to talk to the audience that doesn't follow these numbers, we are being outpaced. They are outrunning us in every aspect of the war fighting. And you're saying, so why does that matter to me? Well, all those things that we have freedoms of in the United States, when there's all of this activity going on that allows the Russians and the Chinese to coerce us into doing activities that we may not want to do, that are not in our best interest, that give us the freedoms that we have, all of those are threatened by these kinds of items. And we're being held back by some policy strings, by leadership strings that say, we don't want to look aggressive. I agree we don't want to aggress our adversaries into doing something that may be bad, but we do need to show enough strength so they don't do something bad to us. There's an interesting balance in the communication. You know, Curtis always talks about the vitamin C's, you know, that communication aspects, that capability, you know, our resolve to be able to use our weapons. And what scares me when I look at this, and I will say it's a scary look, when you look at this chart, and I recommend people go out. Curtis, did you give people where this is located? This is on the DIA site.
Yeah, you just go to the DIA.mil.
Okay. Yeah, there you go. And look up Golden Dome for America, and you'll see the sort of the various threats that are coming to us that may strongly impact your ability to go shop, to go to your college you want to go to buy the car you want to go see the friends you want to see. All of those cease to exist when we lose the freedoms that are coerced out of our country because we decided to sit on our haunches. And I think that's the biggest message I walked away with this. I mean, we'll talk a little bit about some of the systems themselves, but I like sort of going and look at this thing from the 20,000 foot level. What in the world does this mean? This means freedom gets lost when we are coerced into doing something we don't want to do, which is the reason why we have deterrence in the first place.
Well, I think the concern here is this is a 36% deficit? Is that 2-to-1 advantage? I think.
Yeah.
So I think what we have here is in 10 years we'll have a 2-to-1 advantage, we will have a 2-to-1 disadvantage, and this matters. And so where Cato can even think through this, I haven't seen the report, so it's hard to fathom the idea that the best way to solve the problem of a rising threat is to disarm and demobilize. There's nowhere in history does it show that that's been a success for making peace. It does really encourage attack and invasion or whatever you might want to, how you might want to couch sort of that that first strike assault. And the goal to avoid war is to avoid that first strike. And so we have to understand these threats. And what's remarkable about this chart is that DIA is giving us some unclassified numbers. Look, they're estimates. I understand that. But these estimates could have easily been half of these numbers, and people wouldn't have questioned it at all. Certainly not Cato. So the fact that the DIA or any intelligence community, you can generally assume that when they are telling you what the threat is, it's probably a pretty conservative estimate. So my guess is these numbers are still low. That's what my gut instinct tells me, is that it's 700 is probably a probably. And so, and if you go back and look at any of the recent, over the last couple of years, the recent reports of the China military to Congress, those are public reports. You can go out and read them. We haven't had one this year yet, but there was one in 2024 and in 2023 during the Biden administration. And both of them noted, these sort of numbers that we've sort of accepted over the years of 1,700, 1,000, 1,500 when it comes to Chinese warhead progression, that have been reported over these last couple of years. And my guess is these are low estimates because they always use the word probably. We did a podcast and wrote an article on this 2 years ago when the 23 report came out about why the American people should be, you know, pretty exercised about this report. What are they not telling us? So I'm impressed. I'm giving props to the DIA for what I think is getting a little bit closer to the real threat when it comes to this, and I still think it's low. And so we can't stick our heads in the proverbial sand, and the disarmament community is only interested in surrender rather than defense or deterrence, because they simply are unwilling to accept threat as it is, and are unable to discern the balance of power cure that's needed to deal with the real world.
Yeah, but Curtis, I'd even go one step further. If you look, and we'll stick with the ICBM numbers, just you can use any of the numbers on this chart you want. But you say China has currently 400 according to ICBMs, according to this chart. And by 2030, I have bad eyes, but I think it's 2036. Yes. So it's not just my memory going. It's also my eyesight. But so it goes 400 to 700. So even if that increase of 300 is divided in half, so at 400 to 550, how many are we increasing in our modernization and our number of missiles? What's been announced?
So the current program of record does not show an increase in force posture.
Oh, so they're increasing number of ICBMs and we're not increasing anything.
Correct.
So even 150 more is outpacing us. That's, I mean, and people,
Jim,
you got to look, Jim, at all the numbers. Yeah, go ahead, Adam.
Do you not get it? If we increase our numbers, that's destabilizing.
That's correct.
Anytime, what you got to understand is this is... This is the logic. Anytime we do anything to defend ourselves, it's destabilizing. That's why it's logic. It's too complicated for you, Jim. It's not math, it's logic, and it's way too complicated. So the logic is, if we try to defend ourselves, it's destabilizing. What they do, we don't worry about. It's no big deal. See, what you got to do is you got to understand how the force works. And if you understand the force and you take it seriously and you understand that these are not the droids you're looking for, and you just say that, and these are not the ICBMs you're looking for, and you wave your hand, and then any problems that could potentially exist go away. And the Russians won't see us as a threat. The Chinese won't see us as a threat. Yeah, maybe the American dollar ceases to be the currency of international exchange. And then we get to find out what it really means to double or triple the amount of dollars available in circulation. Yeah. Then we get to see what real inflation looks like instead of seeing the U.S. dollar propped up because they want it stable. So, that's an aside, but it's a real world consequence of the United States ceasing to be the global power, which is really what the Russians and the Chinese are after.
Yeah.
And the day that happens, the second and third order effects that Americans are going to feel are such that they're going to be like, holy, exclamation mark, circle,
darn,
whatever. And they're going to be like, this is not what we wanted. And by that point, you're not going to be able to do anything to the arms control and disarmament community. There's going to be no accountability, just like there's no accountability for politicians that have failed us over the last 30 years. But we're all going to be screwed.
Well, Adam, there's a thing called queuing theory that fits into this. Is once it starts, it takes time to queue, just like modernization. It takes time to build the forces. And by then, it's too late. You've got to start early. You've got to look at what's happening and make the decisions on where you're going to head. So part of this chart helps us to decide that. It's, what are we going to do as a country? What are you listeners are going to do about informing your neighbors and your leaders about what we need to be doing in order to deter this, so we don't have that day where you wake up and your dollar is no longer accepted at the local mart because, well, it's been devalued, or all your savings goes to nothing in a short period of time, because it does come down to economics. I will say one other thing. We're talking, I want to get back on on our show. I know I sort of set us off in a different direction. So I'll take responsibility to the listener. We didn't follow our show prep, but try to get us back in. You know, we're talking about ICBMs right now, and I know we're going to talk about SLBMs. But if you look at this chart, when you get to the boosted hypersonic weapons, the land attack cruise missiles, and the fractional orbital bombardment system, or the FOBs, when we get to those are not defensive weapons. Those are offensive weapons, which our adversaries are building and using, you know, Curtis McGiffin's whack-a-mole theory, it gives us too many targets to go after. So which one's going to get through? Oh, and by the way, all five of these are nuclear capable. In fact, primarily nuclear, which also tells you a little bit about what our adversary is doing in terms of building up their forces. They love nuclear. They certainly, you know, show that.
So, I mean, let's just take cruise missiles. So the projection is...
A couple hundred of them, please. Thank you.
Well, the projection is that the Russians and the Chinese will each have about 5,000 cruise missiles within a decade. Mm-hmm. Could you imagine if a fraction of those cruise missiles all started hitting U.S. targets? That's just one of the, you know, five primary systems that they're talking about. And they've got, let's suppose they said, let's keep the majority in reserve. Let's just hit them with 2,000. 2,000. We are in no way prepared to deal with that kind of a strike against the United States. Let's assume it's conventional. I mean, this is a fundamental problem that that we are facing, that we are going to be, and we're in the process, right? It's happening now. We know it's happening because we see the data of becoming so outgunned that our only option is capitulation. Mm-hmm. And that's just not a world I want to live in.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. These are first strike weapons. They are designed to decapitate and blind and deafen our sensors, and actually sort of give a glancing blow and then offer the what we call the nuclear blackmail, right? Which is, if you don't want any more, you will surrender and you will not retaliate. This is different from coercion. Blackmail is after an attack has occurred, and it's the threat of more if you don't capitulate. And so then Americans will have, well, it's not even Americans, the American leadership will have hard decisions to make. And you know, what will the world be like? And I would ask our friends at Cato or any other disarmament community, why is the world safer when the adversaries like China and Russia have all their nuclear weapons, the United States doesn't? How does that make the world safer? I don't understand, because they've shown no desire to disarm in any way or even negotiate.
They'll know you mean no harm at that point.
Is that what it is?
And when you mean no harm, why would they ever attack you?
Yeah, and again, history shows us when there were large number of nuclear weapons. Let's talk about in the 60s. We had a large number of nuclear weapons. The Russians had a large number of nuclear weapons. And we had how many wars with Russia?
Yeah, none.
Huh.
Well, but it's going to be like the Washington Naval Treaty, where we demonstrated our good intentions by getting rid of the battle fleet. And the Brits did the same, and all the good guys did it. And, of course, we demonstrated to the Nazis and to Imperial Japan that we meant them no harm. And when we did that, then they didn't attack anybody. And we never had a world war about that kind of stuff. Because when you demonstrate to people that you mean them no harm, then authoritarian regimes won't hurt you. I mean, the history's obvious, and it's right there in front of your faces. Yeah. I don't know why we're talking about this.
I hear you. So let me ask our resident scientist this, you know, so these fractional orbital bombardment systems, Jim, they say that the Chinese could have up to 60 by 2035. 60? I don't know that the Soviets even had six, much less 60. Can you tell the audience, explain to the audience, what is a FOB?
Yeah, well, I'm an Army guy, so that's a forward operating base. Is that what we're talking about? I must have studied the wrong thing. I'm sorry. No. So it's interesting because I've talked to some people about FOBs before, and they're like fractional. So let me start out by telling you what it is, because people misunderstand. So imagine putting a missile into orbit at a low Earth orbit, and which is going to decay out of orbit, but you can put up into orbit, you can fly in any orbit around the Earth you want to, and then pull it out of orbit by using rockets, and then launch, basically you're launching from there, and you're launching a nuclear weapon. And normally these things fly at about 150, I think, kilometers, maybe 200 kilometers. They're low Earth orbit, so they have a lot of drag, because they're not meant to be in orbit for a long period of time, probably up to, the treaty says they can only go one. They can't go a full orbit technically, because our adversaries follow their treaties, they can only do up to almost, Adam uses a fraction. They cannot do a full orbit. So they have to do a fraction of an orbit. So the idea is they'd be in the air for maybe up to 10 minutes of time, and they pull out of orbit. Now that's basically a orbiting rocket that, deorbits and then launches on you. The problem I have, with it is the treaty verifies whether they can stay in orbit for a long period of time, because we have a space treaty and everyone follows their treaties. So therefore they can't stay up in the air for a long time. Of course, you could build a FOB that's launched, and stays in orbit for maybe up to 90 minutes. But bottom line is, what it does is it can be launched from anywhere during its orbiting time. And I think the Chinese did one that orbited completely, not as a weapon, and then they landed it safely or brought it in safely somewhere else. And the idea is to get away from our northern-oriented radar systems that are primarily looking at the potential of Russia taking the short orbit over the North Pole to get to the United States. And so we have, I think we in Russia, I think we both called them BMUs. I can't remember. Ballistic missile early warning. So we had a ballistic missile early warning system. The idea is that you could use these systems to attack from any direction. This goes back to Curtis's whack-a-mole theorem. It's the best theory in the world. It's almost near Maxwell's equations in my book of things that really work really well. Because the whack-a-mole theory, his concept is that as long as you have a lot of targets in different areas and different locations, you have to account for all of them, and you can't normally account for every bullet coming out. It's sort of like the machine gun, right? I can shoot one round, gotcha. But if I can shoot hundreds of rounds from different locations, you're not going to block them all. And this is the case of an aggressive, as Curtis said, these are first strike weapons, and they are aggressive. They are not defensive weapons. And again, if our adversaries don't follow their treaties, who says they can't put them in space, have space warfare, launch them from there, come into low Earth orbit, and come in from anywhere? There's very little launch warning time. There's very little chance of seeing the weapon coming in. And of course, it comes in from anywhere. So now you got to have a 360-degree, vision on your Iron Dome. And that's where a dome sort of fits. A dome is sort of, concept of a sphere. It's around you 360 degrees and up into the atmosphere. So, but these will bypass a lot of the systems that are looking, high in the sky waiting for something, especially facing north. They don't travel as fast as hypersonic. People oftentimes mix FOBs with hypersonics. They're not traveling as fast. So you have a different dynamic. You have a different signature. And they're not...
But they are hypersonic. I mean, they're not traveling at the speed of an ICBM, Mach 15, but they're traveling at Mach 5.
Yeah, but most people say, you're exactly right. When I say hypersonic, I mean, I'm talking about when people classify the hypersonic glide vehicles, et cetera, they're maneuverable. These aren't maneuverable, but then they come out of nowhere. So you have one weapon that's traveling in one direction. They're hard to shoot down because they can maneuver around. Their targets are not expected. These are the same way. You can't tell where they're going to come from or where they're going. Whereas when an ICBM launches, as it launches and takes its trajectory, we know it's going to have a ballistic trajectory. We know it's going to go up into space. It's going to travel a distance. And we know about where it's going to come back down to. So we can adjust to that. So that's why we look for launch. That's why our satellites are looking at the ground right now. You've got great airmen and Space Force personnel, what they're called, guardians. So you have airmen and guardians right now looking at the ground from our satellites, looking for our rocket launch. And when that rocket launches, it puts out a specific signature that we can track and know where it's going. That's great for an ICBM. It's great because we now can, you know, at least predict about where it's going to go. Hypersonic glide vehicles, I'll use the full word, Adam, thank you for correcting me. Hypersonic glide vehicles are moving fast and are maneuverable, so they can make changes at the last minute. You can't predict. And these weapons, the FOBs, you can't predict where they're going to come from, and it can be launched, like I said, 10 minutes ahead of time. So you're not following this thing wholeheartedly. Those are the two. And they carry nuclear weapons, of course. So, you know, all of these things make them a new type of target, a new type of danger. And again, they are, first strike capabilities that are, you know, they're out there. You know, their deorbiting can happen at any time. We don't know. That's the problem. Did I answer that well enough, Kurt? Yes, I get all excited about these things. Well, because
you went too far with it.
Okay, let me. I didn't
even start with my calculus. Is pulling over.
No, don't pull over, because what you need to know. Okay, yeah. So let me back it up and put it back to where I said before. The problem is they are. By the way, the Russians started this back in 1962. They started building FOBs. Okay, and then they did. They had some very bad launch. So there are some problems with technology. Modern technology, modern rocket technology, gets us where we want to be, but. They're pretty reliable now, especially the Chinese versions, according to what I've read about in the internet. But what really is important to our audience is adversaries are building these offensive weapons to decapitate us first, to cause us to capitulate, as Adam said, and we need to deter that. We need to have systems in place that can deter it. And that is where we need to be putting our teeth, either as a launch on warning, or at least a launch on warning system, or an AI system that can give us all the options this potential vehicle may have, so we can select the right place and the right time to decapitate their first strike. There you go.
All right. Well, unfortunately, we've gone significantly over time. So I want to.
Asked me a question.
And you got to give the answer now. Now is the, have I ever told you that my, one of my great heroes is Il Duce? I've never told you because, you know, when he was the leader of Italy, the only time in Italian history that the trains ran on time, because if you were a train conductor and your train was late, you got shot. So in keeping with the desire to keep the trains running on time, although I'm still probably going to get shot because of how late I am, we're going to go ahead and wrap this up. So with that said, Curtis, final thoughts?
I think what we have here is we as a nation, as a world leader, however you want to couch what it is we do on this planet, we've got to wake up to these threats. And there's only, three ways to deal with them, right? You can convince them to give it up. You can match them and place the threat back on them so that they will now be motivated to mutually give it up, or you're going to have to develop or devise some alternative threat that projects upon them that may be asymmetrical in some other way. So you can decide what you have control over as a nation and what you don't, what you cede to the adversary. And I'll give you a hint. It's the first one. You cede that to the adversary. If you rely on the altruism of the adversary to want to save your American life, good luck. It is only upon us. We can control our destiny, and we've got to be willing to do that. And accepting disarmament behavior and advocacy that says that for some reason that we continue to motivate the adversary to do all these terrible things when we are doing none of them, when we are literally behind in our own modernization, it defies logic and it defies realism. And so it goes to the point here that I will always advocate. Idealism is dangerous. It's dangerous to the nation that is projecting idealism, and it is dangerous to the world that is accepting idealism. And when you don't accept and embrace realism for what it is, you place yourself at risk and you place the world at risk. And I think that is, this chart is an embodiment of that realist threat.
All right, Jim, final thought.
This isn't a technical problem for us. This is a capabilities and a desire problem.
It's a political problem. Yeah. This is a political problem.
They always are.
You're absolutely right, Jim.
And so we solved that. We got it made.
Yeah. Okay, well, I'll leave it there. So thanks, Jim. Thanks, Curtis. Yep. Of course, thanks to you, the listeners, for joining us. Just remember, you know, if you want more, there's still QC events going on. There's, you know, Global Security Reviews publishing new articles each week. So there's a lot of great stuff going on. So stay involved and, you know, keep listening, keep reading. And then, of course, as always, we want to remind you to think deterrence.
Thank you for listening to the NIDS View. This show is produced under the NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a 501c3 organization dependent upon donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength and our national deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I would like to thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative The NIDS View.
The NIDS Podcasting Network.